This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we want to hear about your pet's names. We're taking your calls about what you named your pet, why you picked it, what your pet means to you. That's coming up next. Now, state lawmakers took a close look at former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman's investigation into the 2020 election in Wisconsin with a hearing last week. The testimony included heated exchanges between Gableman and members of the Assembly's Committee on Campaigns and Elections, including Democratic State Representative Mark Spreitzer of Beloit.
It seems that you are firmly in the lane of suggesting that the outcome of the election should have been overturned.
Now, I'm going to stop you right there, Mr. Spreitzer. I am not going to let you put words in my mouth for your cheap political advancement. Stop it.
You hired Mr.
Hoyer. I never said anything about overturning any election. Stop making things up, Mark.
Then why have you hired Mr. Hoyer?
Your constituents deserve better.
Why have you hired Mr. Hoyer?
Shame on you.
Why have you hired Mr. Hoyer, who tried to overturn the will of the people of Wisconsin?
Learning more about what came out of that hearing and where Gableman's investigation is headed, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this election investigation led by the former state Supreme Court Justice, created by Republicans in the Assembly? Do you think the 2020 election needs to be investigated further? Are you satisfied with the other election reviews and court challenges and audits that haven't found problems in the state's election that would have changed the result? Or do you want to see more? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. She's also co-host of the WPR Politics Podcast. Laurel, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with the basics. What was the assigned mission from Republicans in the Assembly for former Justice Gableman with this investigation?
So Assembly Speaker Robin Voss unveiled Gableman as the head of this investigation at the state Republican convention over the summer. And the word that he used at the time was shenanigans, that Gableman was going to look into potential shenanigans related to the 2020 election in Wisconsin. So sort of starting from a premise of there were shenanigans that need to be uncovered. And this was coming, of course, after the state had done a number of audits already that are required in state law, a partial presidential recount, and all of those lawsuits that we saw from various Republican-backed entities that all failed to uncover any shenanigans or any proof of widespread fraud or wrongdoing. But Voss said at the time, there needed to be more done to ensure the public had faith in elections in Wisconsin. So that was sort of Gableman's, you know, task at the outset. Look at what happened in the election, report back, tell us if anything went wrong.
One question has been, who is on Gableman's staff in this? We're starting to get some answers now. What do we know about the team that he's hired with the money granted him by the state legislature?
Well, it has taken quite a while to get a list of employees for Gableman's effort. He really kind of dragged his feet on this. He didn't want to share information about who his staff members were. He acknowledged that there were several of them, but didn't want to disclose them. We just last week got several names, and you heard kind of, you played that clip at the top there of the conflict between State Representative Mark Spreitzer, who's a Democrat, and Gableman over one of the staff in particular and his ties to lawsuits that sought to overturn 2020 election results. And that's kind of a theme that's played out with a lot of the folks that have come to light that are associated with this effort. It's a lot of people who have expressed public opinions that the election wasn't conducted fairly, that have been behind efforts to overturn results, questioning things, advancing ideas that have been disproven. So there's a lot of pushback from folks outside of the probe saying that the probe is biased just based on who Gableman has chosen to be a part of the effort.
Now, we heard a taste of that Assembly Committee hearing. What else, apart from some dramatic moments, what else came out of that hearing? What did we learn there?
Well, it was a much shorter hearing, interestingly. So this was just the second time that Gableman spoke before state lawmakers since his effort was launched over the summer. And the first time he went before a Senate committee, and it was several hours long. They went into the evening. They talked for a really long time. This committee was just an hour long. That's the amount of time that Gableman allotted to lawmakers to talk about this. So a big part of the committee hearing was that back and forth that you heard, concerns about, you know, who the staffers are, who's involved. And then the other big conflict right now about this investigation is the testimony that Gableman is seeking from election officials across the state. The information that he wants, the in-person interviews that he wants, and how he wants to go about doing them. So there was certainly some back and forth about that as well.
Talking to Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, about the ongoing Republican-appointed investigation into last year's 2020 election in Wisconsin. You mentioned that that conflict with mayors in particular, a court filing, in effect, threatening to jail two mayors in Wisconsin. Do I have that right, Laurel? Are you there, Laurel? Seem to have lost Laurel White for the moment. We are talking about the ongoing Gableman investigation into the 2020 elections. We'll give her a quick call, I imagine. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts or concerns about this investigation? Are you glad it's happening? Do you think it's redundant given other recounts and audits that have already happened? What do you want to see happen next? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, learning more about a contentious hearing before the state assembly last week between Michael Gableman and Democratic lawmakers about the ongoing investigation into last November's election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Before we go to our callers, Laurel, a conflict between former Justice Gableman and a couple of mayors of cities in Wisconsin and a threat potentially to jail them. What's going on?
That's right. So what's going on there is that Gableman had subpoenaed several weeks ago five mayors in Wisconsin, the mayors of the five largest cities in the state, to talk to them about election administration in their communities during the 2020 election. A big part of the conversation there are grants that each of these cities received from an organization called the Center for Tech and Civic Life. It's a group associated with Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. Republicans have pushed back on these grants for a long time, saying that they unduly influenced how elections were run in these communities, that it was inappropriate. And so Gableman has sought out conversations with these mayors. But it has been rocky from the very beginning. He scaled back the documents that he was asking for from these communities because the scope was incredibly broad. And now there's conflict back and forth about the in-person interviews and how those are going to happen and if they're going to happen. And two mayors in particular have really had conflict with Gableman. The mayor of Green Bay, Eric Genrich, and the mayor of Madison, Satya Rhodes Conway. And as you said, Gableman is, you know, he's filed a lawsuit. He's essentially seeking, you know, potential jail time for them for refusing to testify in this probe. And their pushback is twofold. One, they say that there hasn't been clear communication about when and how they were supposed to provide this in-person testimony. So they were sort of unclear on whether this was moving forward at all because of some changes that were happening. And secondly, and this is coming from Rhodes Conway, she says she wants her testimony to be in public. She says, I'll speak to you, I'll provide whatever information you want, but I want it to be in front of a legislative committee. I want it to be in public. I want people to be able to see and hear the questions that you ask me and how I respond. And Gableman says he doesn't want to do that. He wants the questions to be in private. He says, you know, doing it in public could compromise the investigation. It could give away some of the things that they're looking into. And he says that that wouldn't be good. That's not how these things should be done. So there is, as I mentioned, pending litigation about this. And there's going to be a hearing later this month.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Liz is with us in Waukesha. Liz, hi.
Hi, Rob. Hi there. I have a problem with the Republican agenda. It seems to me between the gerrymandering of maps and the shackling of Governor Evers' power during their lame duck session, and now kind of a secret sort of investigation into a election that has already been probed quite extensively, that leads me to be suspicious. What is it that they're seeking, or what is it they're hoping to find, or are they going to twist things this time so that it appears that there was some fraud? I just don't trust their agenda. It's too sinister, in my opinion.
Liz, thanks for the wall. Liz, for the call, Liz referred, Laurel, to the other audits and things that have gone on. Can you remind us of the more recent the audits up to this date, including the Legislative Audit Bureau's audit?
The Legislative Audit Bureau report, which comes from the nonpartisan legislative office that conducts audits for the state, that was just released in late October. And it found, again, like a number of other things that came before it, that there wasn't any widespread fraud, there wasn't any wrongdoing, nothing that would have changed the outcome of the election in Wisconsin. It did point out several areas where state laws could be changed and updated, state policies that are have been in place from the State Elections Commission that should be updated. And so it has caused, even without saying that there was widespread fraud or wrongdoing, kind of turmoil in state government, because lawmakers are pushing for changes. They're criticizing the Elections Commission, saying that, you know, even the administrator of the Elections Commission needs to step down because of some of the things that were pointed out in the audit. So that's something that's taken up a lot of space in state government over the past several weeks, and very separate from this Gableman investigation. But again, it did not find anything that would have changed the outcome of the election, just some suggestions for changes moving forward to some state policies.
Liz, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Brad joins us next in Arpin. Brad, hello. I think we lost Brad, is what that ding meant. Okay, we'll go to Jimmy in Valley Junction now. Jimmy, hello.
Good afternoon. I said initially the cost of this was estimated at $800,000. And my question is, how open-ended is the length of this investigation and the cost? And where do they actually appropriate this money from that they're using to conduct it? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Jimmy, thanks for the call. Laurel, the costs and how it's being paid for.
Yeah, so the cost is it's just a little bit shy of $700,000. And that's been approved by the state legislature already. That was the initial budget, taxpayer funded. And the question about how long the investigation is going to go on and if it's going to need additional funding is a great question, and one that we've posed to Assembly Speaker Voss, who spearheaded this whole thing. And he says that he hopes it doesn't need to go on much longer. He hasn't weighed in on what potential additional costs may be. There are actually a number of requests out from media outlets, from different groups, trying to get more information about the contracts and the agreements for this investigation. And Voss has refused to release those publicly, citing some of the similar reasons that Gableman did when he said he didn't want testimony to happen in public when he talks to those mayors. So we don't know a lot about, you know, what happens if this goes long. The investigation's already gone a bit longer than folks expected. It was expected to be wrapped up around the same time as that Legislative Audit Bureau audit that ended in late October. So there is a definite possibility here that more money, in addition to the roughly $700,000 that's already been approved, would need to be allocated for this if it's going to go on.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White about the ongoing Republican-appointed investigation of last year's elections. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Want to give a listen to former Justice Gableman talking earlier this week. Here's a listen.
My work and my employees will be judged by one thing, and that is the finished work product. And right now, what is preventing the finished work product is the fearful running and hiding of those government officials who do not want to be held accountable and who do not want to tell the public what they did with the Zuckerberg money and why they did it.
And Laurel, that gets back into, in part, the dispute with mayors. But there's been a bunch of kind of legal stumbles along the way. Some of the initial requests were from a John Delta pseudonym email, right? There's been a lot of weird legal glitches that have made communication really weird between all parties.
Yeah, there have absolutely been bumps in the road. As you mentioned, some initial emails to local election officials came from a Gmail account associated with someone named John Delta. There were concerns about that account being secure, whether it was legitimate in the requests it was sending to these local officials for information. And there's been that pushback that I mentioned, you know, the mayors of Madison and Green Bay, their in-person testimony, the lawsuit over that, Gableman threatening to jail them if they don't agree to testify in person. There's a separate lawsuit that has to do with the administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission and whether she is going to testify in person and provide information to Gableman. And that's a lawsuit that involves the state attorney general, because in his capacity, Josh Call represents the Wisconsin Elections Commission because it's a state agency. And his argument is that the Gableman investigation has a lot of legal shortfalls, that there are a lot of problems there, that it's acting outside the legislature's authority, that it's attempting to be a criminal investigation, which it shouldn't be doing, also pushing for in-person testimony if testimony is going to be given. And a hearing in that case is kind of backed right up against a hearing in the case with the mayors. And those are both scheduled for later this month. So, as you mentioned, certainly kind of legal conversations, legal conflicts from the beginning, and looks like more to come.
Let's go back to our callers now. Tony is on the line in Tomahawk. Tony, hi.
Hi. My concern is that Democrats in the legislature have been so timid in trying to play by, like, polite rules. Gableman couldn't even run for Supreme Court justice again because he's incompetent. He can't file a legal brief. You mentioned glitches and, you know, legal misstatements all over the place. The guy is not competent. The whole thing is just an exercise in trying to please Donald Trump, apparently. It's just a bunch of noise, and the Democrats need to talk back to this and say, this is just crap. This is just nonsense. A waste of taxpayer money. They need to stop allowing it to happen. And demand that the money be repaid back. These people are not investigators any more than the cyber ninjas were in Arizona. This is just foolishness.
Tony, thanks for the call. What are we hearing from Democrats, Laurel?
Well, we are certainly hearing that from Democrats. Governor Tony Evers has expressed frustration, said that it's a waste of time, it's a waste of money. The thing is, Republicans have the control in the state legislature. They have the strong majorities, and there really isn't anything that Governor Evers or the Democratic minority can do practically to block this from moving forward. They can voice that criticism, which they have, but just because of the strong Republican majority in state government right now, they have the, you know, kind of the autonomy, the ability to move forward with things like this. So that's just kind of the way things stand right now. In terms of Gableman's competence, that's something that Democrats have brought up as well. Gableman has been open about his lack of knowledge, personal knowledge about election administration in Wisconsin. He said in an interview that he doesn't really understand the process, doesn't understand the intricacies of it. And Democrats have pushed back and said, well, why should we trust someone who's coming from a basis of, you know, self-admitted low level of knowledge to look into something like this? So Democrats have been pushing back, but there are limits on what they can do with that pushback.
Tony, thanks for calling. Fawn joins us next in Madison. Fawn, hi.
I agree wholeheartedly with the previous caller. I think I'm completely alarmed. I think this is an alarming threat to democracy. that all this insistence on secrecy of Gableman, on the part of Gableman and Ross and the others, that all the secrecy is just going to drive, you know, the Washington Post has the motto, democracy dies in darkness. And that's exactly what they're trying to do, trying to pull all these shenanigans and using these tactics of harassment and intimidation by threatening jail time. That's like the Carla said, it's just a lot of noise. The entire matter is trumped up, no pun intended, is just fabricated. And it's just to make a lot of noise and banging pots and pans for no good reason. I think there should be a suit brought against Gableman at all for wasting taxpayer money. If the state can't do it, possibly a civic group could do it.
Vaughn, thanks for the call. There is, I think, a suit that's been filed against Assembly Speaker Voss or trying to get a court to declare him in contempt of court, Laurel, for not sharing some of the information you were talking about earlier.
That's absolutely right. And that's moving forward just as these lawsuits about, you know, the in-person testimony are moving forward. So we're going to continue to get decisions to have the judiciary weigh in on this. But there haven't been any cases trying to block the probe from moving forward in a way other than, the conflict over the in-person testimony.
Thanks for that call. Laurel, just in our last less than a minute now, what are you watching for next? A lot of moving parts here.
Yeah, I think those decisions are going to be a big factor moving forward, whether these local officials are going to have to provide in-person testimony, whether that testimony is going to be in public or behind closed doors, as Gableman wants it to be. And then just obviously keeping a really close eye on, if this does move forward, how much longer it's going to take. This was supposed to be wrapped up in the fall. So if this stretches into 2022, how long, what is Gableman looking into, and how much additional money might taxpayers be on the hook for it?
Laurel, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter, co-host of the WPR Politics Podcast. She was with us today to talk about the latest in former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman's probe of Wisconsin's 2020 election. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, it's this week's edition of Ask a Contractor, with affordable home repairs and additions that can make a big difference without breaking the bank. Find out more tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to Aaron Collins, also known as the Mask Nerd, about all the masks he's tested and which ones are the best. Now, we got a lot of show pitches on Central Time. We got one recently that got us thinking. A pet insurance company called Trupanion surveyed its database to see what the most popular pet names were. If you're interested, the top dog names were Bella, Luna, and Charlie. For cats, the top names were Luna, Milo, and Oliver. Now, those were the top names from just one company. That got us wondering about your pets and their names and how you chose those names. You could join in right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What's the name of your pet? A dog, cat, goldfish, gerbil, ferret? What's the story behind the name? Do you name after a favorite musician or other celebrity, someone special in your life? Or is this really personal to that pet? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. The name of your pet and the story behind said name. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. While you're calling in at 800-642-1234, we've heard from a bunch of people electronically. Billy emailed saying that naming dogs is usually a long process. Billy has three dogs and says, quoting here, "My bulldog/beagle mix is named Lottie after my grandmother. Prior to her choosing to live with us, we had a Shih Tzu named Nelson after my grandfather, so it seemed like the perfect name. Many ways she fits the name and reminds me of my grandmother." And Sandra wrote, "Marlo came to us from a friend who was allergic to him. His name is Marlo, M-A-R-L-O. Sandra had no idea why, but figured that cats don't care about spellings. They change it to Marlo, M-A-R-L-O-W-E. Sounds the same. Sandra says he's creative. He could be named after Christopher Marlowe, the English playwright. Since he's curious, he could be named before Philip Marlowe, the fictional detective. We love Marlo either way." Well, let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Christina starts us off in Pewaukee. Christina, hi.
Hi there. We have a very pampered pug whose name is Hercules Mulligan.
Hercules Mulligan.
we're of the opinion that small dogs should have big names. They don't have a complex. And Hercules Mulligan is a character in the musical Hamilton, who's actually based on a real-life figure by the same name. So it's also quite a heroic name.
And does Hercules have a heroic personality?
No, he's very silly. And we call him Hermie for short, and Hermie's probably a much better match.
That sounds about right. That sounds about right. Thank you so much. I love it. Hermie, a.k.a. Hercules Mulligan. Christina, thanks for getting us started. Let's go to Mark next in Bloomer. Mark, hi.
So we got ourselves a new kitten, and we thought it was a girl, and we couldn't come up with a name. But now we found out it's a boy, and we don't have a name. And I'm hoping that somebody out there can help us find a good boy cat name that's like a good boy cat name, because I don't have a name yet.
Oh, no.
I keep calling him Kitty.
Keep calling him Kitty. Yeah, you don't want to let that stick. Okay, listeners, you can help Mark name his boy kitty TBD named right now. Good luck, Mark. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Just saw a survey sort of thing of the most popular pet names, asking about what you named your pets and why. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Rebecca is with us now in Oconomowoc. Rebecca, hi.
Hi. Yeah, well, I just wanted to tell you a real quick story. When I was picking up my dog as a puppy and driving home, I got this sort of insight that he should be named Argus. I didn't know what it meant, and I thought, well, that's kind of a good name, and I looked it up when I got home, and it was actually a Greek name from Old Greek, the mythology.
Mm-hmm. Like, and the one with tons of 100 eyes, right? It was always watching,
right,
everything.
Exactly. 100-eyed guardian, and when it was killed by Zeus, it became the peacock, and it means vigilant and bright, and it really fits this little guy. This is a little Scottish terrier.
Very watchful, even with just two eyes, right?
That's right.
Rebecca, thank you so much for sharing the story, the origin story of Argus. Let's go to John next in Marinette. John, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What's your pet name, John?
Well, I got this German Shepherd dog. He's 4 years old now, but when I went up to Escanaba, Michigan to pick him up, he fit in the palm of my hand, and he looked like a hairy little baked potato, so he ended up being named Tater.
Tater. Now, I'm just going to guess he doesn't fit in your hand anymore, John.
No, he sure don't. No, he can put his paws on my chest and give me a kiss on the face.
Awesome. Is he a couch potato, or is he a pretty active Shepherd, John?
Well, both. You know, he lives in the house, but he spends a lot of time outside. Baronet's a really tiny little town, and he's so good I can leave him, just open the door and leave him out. He stays in the yard. Neighborhood kids, when they see him, they come running over to play with him. He's the best dog I ever had, best friend I got right now.
All right. Tater sounds like a great dog, John. Thank you so much. Taking your stories of the name of your pet, why you came up with it, how it got the name. And remember, we're still looking for a good kitten name. I should be asking everybody for that. All right, Carissa joins us now in Waukesha. Carissa, hi.
Hi.
What's your pet name story, Carissa?
Well, I adopted a tortoise, and my roommate came up with the name Tortellini.
Nice.
And I just got another tortoise, and I'm thinking I'm going to call her Ravioli.
Awesome. Now, tortoise, I once had a turtle, you know, and it had kind of an aquatic, yeah, you know, half water tank. This is a tortoise, though. You got a couple tortoises.
I do. I have two tortoises, and they have so much personality for a reptile. I get home from work, and my tortoise, he comes running out to say hi, and he wants to, you know, me to let him out, and he crawls all over, and they're a lot faster than you might think they are.
Okay. Now, we're looking for a kitten name. Can you hit us with a kitten name, Carissa? You're pretty good with pasta themed names.
Well, you know, like fettuccine, I don't know, spaghetti.
All right. Fettuccine or spaghetti the kitten, those are the offers on the table. Taking your stories of the names of your pets, where you came up with them, at 800-642-1234. Helene is with us next in Lake Delton. Helene, hi.
Hi there, Rob. I've got a kitten name. I named my kitten. He showed up one night just out of nowhere, showed up after dark, feisty as could be. He was so little. He wasn't scared of the outdoor cats at all. And he was so tiny, I named him Kitten Little.
Kitten Little. I love it.
Kitten Little, and he grew.
Not little anymore.
And he grew. And when he got to be about 15, 16, 17 pounds, I couldn't keep a straight face when I went to the veterinarian. Said, I got Kitten Little to see it. So I named him Normus.
Normus.
He is Normus. He's enormous. And he came from Normus's farm. He came from Normus's plate, stopped by Pleasantville.
Oh, I love it.
Yes, and he's a true, I don't know what to say, honor. It's an honor to have a kitty named Norma, Sir Norman.
I love it. Thank you so much for that, Helene. We'll go next to Diane in Iron County. Diane, hi.
Hi. We got a dog up in Saxon, the northern part of Iron County. He was a Border Collie Blue Heeler from a farm, and so we named him Earl of Saxon.
I love it. And does he have a noble demeanor?
He did. He passed away
he did.
A while ago.
Okay. I'm sorry about that.
Yeah. Oh, no problem. He was a great dog.
It's a
cool name.
Great name. I love it, Diane. Thank you so much. Earl of Saxon. Time for one more caller. Eric is with us in Rice Lake. Eric, hello.
Hey, I just want to give you a name of a German Shepherd I had. He was born with only one testicle. He was missing a testicle, and we named him Lefty.
Lefty, okay. I won't guess which one he was missing then, Eric. Thank you so much for sharing that story. Hopefully that's a fairly unique circumstance. I don't know. You can keep sharing your pet names and the story behind them. We got a lot of them on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Maybe we'll have to come back and share some of those later this week. Again, share them on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the history of an iconic beverage.
What's the first drink you think of when you hear this sound? A Pepsi, a Miller Lite, or was it a Jolly Good Soda, a drink that has its roots right here in Wisconsin? A can of Jolly Good Soda is one of the many items included in the Wisconsin 101 Project, which tells the state's history through objects. WPR's Rachel Vasquez visited the Jolly Good plant to reintroduce us to a Midwestern favorite.
If you're having trouble remembering Jolly Good, maybe this will ring a bell.
The next time you're in a food store buying cola, root beer, orange, or any flavored soda, take a good look at the price. I mean a really good look. At Jolly Good, we believe in quality, but we also believe in value. We want you to get your money's worth.
Jolly Good was beloved by Midwesterners in its heyday. Greer Foods started the brand in the 1970s in Belgium, Wisconsin, but after decades of filling fridges across the region, competition from the big soda companies edged them out. They sold the last case of Jolly Good in 2007. But then 2013 rolled around, and an uncle and his nephew had an idea.
The term craft became very popular in the beer industry. Was there some opportunity for us to play off that niche?
That's John Rassel, the nephew of the pair, and now the president of Greer Foods. His uncle, Bruce Greer, headed the company before him.
He was the one that really propelled Jolly Good to what it was.
The two talked about if they could relaunch the brand and how it would work. Soon enough, they had a shot at putting it back on store shelves.
So we just decided to make a small batch and see what happens.
Rassel says their first big win was getting Jolly Good into Piggly Wiggly. But before long, they were selling in retailers like Woodman's Markets, Sendix, and now their latest retail partner, Festival Foods.
Right now, I think we would deem it as a success.
Today, the company makes Jolly Good at their facility in the small community of Random Lake, about 20 miles outside of Sheboygan. They produce 8 regular flavors and 7 diet, including cherry, cream, and the beloved Sour Power. Before the cans get to you, each and every one goes through a special process. First, they mix it all up in a place they call the batch room.
So we have 2 8,000-gallon tanks and then 2 6,000-gallon tanks. So we batch the liquid back here, and then we send it out to the filler to be put into the cans.
Next, some tests to make sure it's all up to snuff, and then all of that soda and a bunch of empty cans are sent to the filler room, which always smells like whatever flavor is being filled. That machine goes very fast.
700 to 800 cans a minute.
From there, the cans are sent over to be boxed up and shrink-wrapped. And then they're put on a pallet in a warehouse with cans that go as far as you can see. That's where they wait before they head out to stores across Wisconsin, along with a few places in Illinois. Even with the pandemic, Rassel says Jolly Good has been doing well. But he says they've also got ground to make up with customers they missed when they had to stop selling.
If you do the math from 2007 to 2014, when we weren't on the shelves, we missed a generation.
Rassel says they have some help with that, though, from older generations who still know and love Jolly Good.
Part of it is that those older generations remembering the brand, remembering the memories, and wanting to recreate those memories with the younger generation. It's very impactful, this, you know, especially during this time.
That's where a lot of the brand's power comes from, the nostalgia people feel for it.
Whether it was camping, ball games, you know, the lake house, the beach, you know, you name it. Everyone, you know, just kind of reached out, you know, oh, I remember drinking Jolly Good.
Rassel's uncle Bruce passed away before he had a chance to see Jolly Good come to life again. He says it was important to pay homage to him and his work building Jolly Good.
Hopefully you'd be proud. I think we did a pretty good job.
WPR's Rachel Vasquez brought us that story on Jolly Good Soda. It's part of the Wisconsin 101 Project, which tells our state's history through objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, what's in a mask? An engineer who has tested about every mask on the market tells us what his data shows about which masks are the best. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Cloth masks have become a standard for being out and about during the pandemic. They're cheap and convenient. For a long time, they were the only thing available to most people. But now safer masks like the N95s and KN95s are widely available. So why aren't more people wearing them? Our next guest says it's time to ditch cloth masks altogether. Aaron Collins is a mechanical engineer with a background in aerosol science who decided to set up an at-home lab to test as many masks as he could online. He's known as the Mask Nerd. Aaron, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, once upon a time, Aaron, I think the attitude was the best mask to wear is the one you could actually get your hands on. You say it's time, though, to move on from cloth. Make the case.
Sure. I mean, I think cloth masks made sense at the beginning of the pandemic. We were really constrained about what was available to us. And really, cloth masks are definitely better than no mask at all. But the level of protection that cloth masks provide, really relative to the technology that we have in modern surgical masks or even respirators, like KF94s, KN95s, and N95s, really just to me doesn't make sense anymore. And so when we talk about cloth masks, really it was about what we call source control, or what we often say was protecting others. But in inhalation protection, or when we breathe in, cloth masks really don't provide a ton, typically in anywhere from 30 to 65%, depending on the exact type of mask. And so the technology that we have is this material called Meltblown, and it's like it's electrostatically charged. And so it like basically sucks particles too. It's really incredible technology. And it's really inexpensive and readily available now. And you'll find that commonly in those like blue square masks called surgical masks or procedure masks. And it's the first mask or the first level of mask to kind of feature that technology. But the problem with surgical masks is while they have the technology, they kind of lack three things that we care about when we talk about masks. So we talk about masks, we talk about fit, we talk about filtration, and we talk about comfort. And so the surgical mask has the filtration. I would argue maybe not so much on the comfort side because they suck to your mouth, but for surely in terms of fit, not great, right? They puff out on the sides and they leak through the nose wire, which kind of can feel blowing into your eyes. And so then you move to that kind of next level, and I call them protective masks or high filtration masks, but the technical term is a respirator. And those respirator standards you often hear are like KF94, KN95, N95. And when we talk about that same thing, so what's nice about these is they're specifically designed to fit to your face, so you're going to get like a really good seal to your face, preventing air from going around the mask, because really we want all that air to go through the mask. It also features really high-end filtration media. And so that filtration media means that you don't have to focus on like all of those things simultaneously. It's going to give you that protection. And so then what it comes down to is comfort and one finding that fits your face well and is comfortable for you to wear, whether you like ear loops or headbands. And those masks anywhere from like, you know, depends on exactly how well it fits your face, but kind of test data shows up between 85% to 99% protection, which is pretty incredible relative to that 30 to 50 with a cloth mask.
And can you talk about what led you to set up a testing lab in your bathroom?
That's a great question. So about last fall, we didn't really have a lot of availability of N95s. So there was some alternatives like KN95 coming out of China and KF94 masks out of South Korea. And I kept kind of wondering, and my wife actually mentioned to it, I was kind of complaining that I couldn't figure out if they're real or not. And she kind of looked at me and said, well, can't you test them? It's kind of what you do. And I said, I guess I can. So I went off to create a lab and start testing lots of masks.
And how do you test those?
Yeah, so what's the technical term is a total inward leakage test. But basically, I use a high-tech scientific device called a condensation particle counter to measure particles as small as a few nanometers. I use that to measure the concentration of particles outside the mask. Then I put the mask on, and I measure the concentration inside the mask. And the difference between that is the as-worn filtration efficiency. And so I use like a sodium chloride test aerosol and a bunch of kind of high-tech stuff. But basically, it allows me to measure how effective a mask is right on my face.
Now, suppose we get one of those N95s or the other good ones you mentioned. How many times can we use it? When does it start to lose its maskiness?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I actually did some work earlier this year wearing masks and testing them. What I found from my work is that with 40 hours of total wear time, so like total amount of time on my face, in a typical indoor office environment, so not a construction site or something like that, but indoor office environment, 40 hours, and didn't really have any measurable impact to the filtration efficiency. And with N95s, that's also the case. In fact, N95s are tested up to 200 milligrams of loading, which is a super science-y term. But that amount of material that would take to load that, if you wore that mask, let's say in Beijing, it's like a month of continuous wearing before you would even get close to hitting that number. So my data really matches the existing test standards as well. So the answer is until it stops fitting you. Normally it's the headbands that stretch out, or mechanically it just kind of gets a little not as snug to your face. So 40 hours or when it doesn't fit really well, whichever happens first.
Oh, we've got a caller who's wondering about bigger randomized control tests on masks. Do you think we need more big research apart from mask nerd in his bathroom on these masks?
I would love to see government agencies really pick up this work. There are some other people that have been started testing, but yeah, I think in general, I want to see a lot more work in this as well as regulation, right? Right now, the N95 is good. KN95s, there are fakes out there, and that comes because there isn't really a regulatory body checking KN95s. KF94s, though, are good. They have the Korean FDA. They do basically a certification process similar to like NIOSH does with our N95. So I would love to see a lot more work in this space for sure.
You mentioned fakes. I saw you quoted in an article, I think it was New York Times, on counterfeit masks. How do we know if the mask we're ordering online or buying in a store is counterfeit?
It's the million-dollar question, and part of the reason I started this work. In general, KN95 seem to suffer from it the most, and that's because the KN95 standard is just a standard. There's no government agency behind it testing or checking anyone's work. So in general, what my recommendation are is there are a ton of N95s and KN95s available from companies like Project N95. If you Google that, they have a whole clearinghouse of PPE, really great place to get it. N95s can be also purchased at large retailers, Home Depot, CVS. When you start talking online, that's where it comes into play. The Amazon KN95, I usually check them and avoiding it. There's been a lot of fakes that pop on there. Doesn't mean all are fake, but it's really hard to tell. As a consumer, I can show you two masks. They would look identical in your hands. One might test at 60%, one at 99%, and you could not tell the difference.
Should we double mask?
You know, I think if that's all you got, sure. But relative to what I'm talking about here, and most people kind of blow their mind, they think respirators is like these really heavy duty items. What I found from my testing is that double masking is considerably more difficult to breathe in than a good or moderate KF94 N95. In fact, even a cloth mask is actually harder to breathe in. That's what most people don't really understand, is that mid to high end of those masks are easier to breathe in than a cloth mask, a quote-unquote good cloth mask, or a double mask situation. So in my opinion, just go for the good stuff.
It's a good place to leave it. Aaron, thanks a lot for sharing your research with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Aaron Collins, the self-proclaimed mask nerd. He talked to us about which masks are best, how to get a legit N95 mask and avoid counterfeits, and why he says it's time to be done with cloth. You can check out his data on masks on YouTube by searching Aaron Collins or the mask nerd. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the Remain in Mexico policy is making a comeback, requiring Central American migrants to stay on the south side of the U.S.-Mexico border while applying for asylum. We'll find out why and what it means. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time.